And we'll start with those film reviews. Spider-Man Far From Home, we see how Peter Parker and friends head off to Europe. That comes in just over 2 hours, by the way. Vita and Virginia details the intimate relationship between Virginia Woolf and her muse, Vita Sackville-West. That comes in just under 2 hours. And the German language film Never Look Away, which takes 3 hours to follow 30 years in the life of a great artist, loosely based this on the true life story of Gerhard Richter, all of which means Ruth Barton and Simon Marr have spent 7 hours in the cinema on our behalf. Thank you very much. And we're going to find out.
7 hours of pure pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to find out if it's going to be, if it was all worth it now over the next 20 minutes or so. It's almost like a full day's work, that. Let's start with Spider-Man Far From Home. Now, I really don't want to ask the question, where does this fit into the Marvel Comics universe? Because if you're a fan, you'll know exactly where it fits in. And if you're not a fan, you'll be confused after the first explanation. So let's just say what Spider-Man is doing. He's gone off to Europe.
He's gone off with a school trip to Europe. He is, I'm in the second category of no idea, but the film is not difficult to follow. So I can tell you this. Spider-Man is off on a school trip to Europe. He has reluctantly got his spider gear with him, but he is in fact determined to have a romantic encounter with MJ, played by Zendaya, who is a teen pop idol, apparently. And so they have a cool time in Europe, but every time they hit a big city, this spooky monster appears.
They go to London. Do they go to many cities to get a good, nice trip?
Get a good trip. It's basically, Spider-Man's European vacation.
All right.
And so they have all sorts of fun with their kind of geeky, but, very nice teen friends. But every time that they do go anywhere, this spooky monster threatens them. Spider-Man, of course, donning his suit and his special glasses, which have been bequeathed to him by Tony Stark, who is, I think, should we spoil it by saying dead?
Okay,
we won't spoil anything about Tony Stark. Though you find out.
Tony Stark, who's not in this movie.
He doesn't appear in this movie from the beginning. And so he can, of course, zap these horrible monsters, but then he is tricked into handing over his special glasses. And this also doesn't help him get the girl, so he's in a bit of a quandary.
All right, Spider-Man is saving the world, but instead of being usually around his own neighbourhood, which is the kind of Spider-Man shtick, isn't it? Now he is doing it around the cities of Europe. That's kind of what we're talking
about.
That's
pretty much it. And he's not entirely comfortable with that. And he talks a lot about the fact that he likes hanging around and being your neighbourhood superhero in Queens. He's a non-globalist superhero, and all he wants to do is go away. But his auntie, as Ruth said, has packed his bag for him and packed his suit, and now he's in these various cities. And you know that, as with every one of these movies, it has to build to a crescendo. And in this case, it's going to be the fight between him and Jake Gyllenhaal, who is also fighting this, water monster, let's call him.
Yeah.
And this time, the big battle is going to take place in London.
And a water monster, that's why he's in Venice, I guess. He has to be there for that. So Jake Gyllenhaal is kind of his sidekick, but he's a big grown-up superhero.
He's
Mysterio. And in the clip we're about to listen to, Spider-Man, is played by Tom Holland. We'll talk about the other Spider-Mans in a minute. Spider-Men, rather, in a minute. And here he is, Spider-Man, being briefed by Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson. And Maria Hill, Kobe Smulders, is also in this clip, along with the Jake Gyllenhaal character.
This is Mr. Beck.
But you handled yourself well out there today. I saw what you did with the tower.
Thanks.
They were born in stable orbits within black holes, creatures formed from the primary elements, air, water, fire, earth. The science division had a technical name. We just called them elementals.
Versions of them exist across our mythologies.
Turns out the myths are real.
Like Thor. Thor was a myth, and now I study him in my physics class.
These myths are threats.
They first materialized on my Earth many years ago. I was part of the last battalion left trying to stop them. All we did was delay the inevitable.
The elementals are here now, attacking the same coordinates. Our satellites confirm it.
We have one mission. Kill it. And you're coming with us.
Mr. Fury, this all seems like big time. Huge superhero kind of stuff. And I'm just a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, sir.
Bitch, please, you've been to space.
I know, but that was an accident, sir. Come on, there's gotta be someone else you can use. What about Thor?
Off-world.
Okay, Doctor Strange.
Unavailable.
Captain Marvel.
Don't invoke her name.
They're all off making other movies in the Marvel Comics universe. So who did, let's just remind who we had there. Tom Holland as Spider-Man, Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, Jake Gyllenhaal as Mysterio, who's also Mr. Beck, isn't
Beck,
he?
Yes.
And Maria Hill then as Cobie Smulders, who has that brilliant line about the elementals, that versions of them exist across all mythologies, though she does it in a female voice rather than a deep American voice.
But remember, across Spider-Man all the time, there can be infinite Spider-Man. So what we learned in the previous Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is that it so happens that Tom Holland is Peter Parker in Queens in this particular dimension
at the same time,
but there could be there could be infinite other
and multiverses.
That's where a lot of these come from, as they have to break through from other parts of the multiverse.
I so admire you, Simon, because you actually know what's going on in the movie.
I'm a nerd.
I was almost afraid to ask about what blinked back means, but is it basically that you can wind back in time in multiverses? Universes can exist.
As far as I can see, they're wiped out, I presume, at the end of another movie, right? So Earth, half of Earth is wiped out, and then that half is blinked back again. So in the blink of an eye, they're back, but they have actually lost 5 years of their lives. So I quite like that conceit. It comes at the beginning. And so a teenage boy suddenly finds that his younger brother is now 5 years older than him. And this sets up a really nice bit of fun. And I was kind of sorry they didn't follow through with it, because they set it up at the beginning and then they just drop it. And that would have been a fantastic story.
But basically we're talking about good versus evil here.
Absolutely.
The big elemental water boys are water men, I suppose they are actually the nasties.
They're the nasties. They have to be stopped.
Tom Holland, Jake Gyllenhaal and Samuel L. Jackson are kind of fighting against that.
Yes.
Right. So that's it.
Yeah. That's fine. And you know that it has to be. You know that everything works towards this one big battle, because this has to happen. Because even if you don't do it, it's going to echo through all the other bits of the multiverse and stuff anyway. So things that have to be stopped here and now.
All right. So that's the kind of the superhero bit. But there's also Peter Parker, who's just, you know, the guy next door. And MJ, played by Zendaya, who I guess is the kind of the girl next door, is she in this?
Yeah, sure. They're all very, very wholesome. And you know, they're very careful to have a multi-ethnic group, although they don't refer to this, but this is a slice of contemporary American life, and these are decent, clean kids. And one of the things about this movie is, you know, if you are if you've got the grandkids for summer and you're wondering could you take them to it,
you can
do, because there is no smut in this film. There's no threat in this film, and remarkably, when they have these huge set piece fights over London, for instance, they're also there's nobody on the street, so very conveniently nobody gets killed, no passers-by are injured. So it is a very, very safe watch.
Well, here's a scene between the aforementioned Peter Parker, Tom Holland, who I keep calling Billy Elliot, because that's how I see him still. Tom Holland is the actor's name, and Zendaya, who is playing the character of MJ. And like the good young adults that they are, they're off to the Opera House. Is this in Venice? Is this in Italy?
So they don't want to go because it's not their choice of country.
Well, here's the conversation.
You look really pretty.
Therefore, I have value?
No. No, that's not what I meant at all. I was just...
I'm messing with you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You look pretty, too.
Oh, my gosh, opera glasses.
So cute.
Can I...
Want to go in on a pair?
You mean let's sit next to each other?
Yeah.
Parker, are you in position?
No.
Okay, no.
Why the hell
you not? Don't want to.
I didn't mean that. If you go ahead, I'll go grab us a pair.
Okay.
No, I'm coming.
There you go. And obviously we heard he has an earpiece in the Opera House, but Samuel L. Jackson's telling him, would you get into position where you're supposed to be to fight the Waterman?
She hears Spider-Man. She doesn't hear Samuel Jackson speak. So this is such an old movie gag, right?
Yeah. But look, I suppose the big question here is, number one, do the big effects work? Number two, is it fun?
I would have said it's fun if you're aged about 10. And I think that...
Is it kind of a young adult audience, maybe be a bit older than that?
Yeah, I didn't go to the press screening. I went to with the public screening, and it was... I would have said the audience spread was from about 8, 9 through to 80, 90.
But it would have been teens.
Yeah, right, it's kind of like the movie that you go to on your own with your mate, and mum and dad don't have to come with you.
And you either imagine that you're MJ or Peter Parker.
Yeah, lived through this fantastic fantasy. I thought it was utterly harmless. I thought, you know, the effects were you know, okay, they were pretty good. In fact, it's nice to see it on the big screen. It does what it promises.
And stars?
Well, I give it 3.5. I know that sounds a bit mean, but I thought it could have done a lot more too.
All right. What did you think, Simon?
I thoroughly enjoyed this. I was surprised because I'm not necessarily the biggest superhero fan in the world, but there's something about Spider-Man that's always had a bit of a lighter touch. And I think Tom Holland has been remarkable when it's come to this role in the last couple of movies. And the multiverse is very good. This is very good. So I think this is a solid 4.
A solid 4 from you. Andrew from Dunleary. Did your reviewer spot Irish actor Claire Dunne in Spider-Man character called Victoria? Yep, that'll be a no. Well, they didn't, but congratulations to Claire Dunne and for her part of Victoria in Spider-Man. Let us move on then to Vita and Virginia, based on the series of letters between Vita Sackville-West and Virginia Woolf. I suppose lots of people will know who Virginia Woolf is. They mightn't be as familiar with Vita Sackville-West. Essentially, one of the muses for Virginia Woolf along the way, Simon?
Yeah, she was the inspiration, and this is something that comes out to the film. The film sort of hangs on. She ends up being the inspiration for Orlando, which is of course one of Virginia Woolf's most famous books. But I suppose they're living in that sort of early 1920s London. You know, it's post-war. They're both would be reasonably well off. They're both sort of, they've both married well, I suppose the phrase they would have used. But there's something missing. Virginia Woolf hears Vita on the radio when she's on talking with her husband. And well, then there's something where they're going to meet.
Virginia Woolf rather, listening to Vita Sackville-West on the radio. We should point out who the actors are here. Gemma Arterton is Vita Sackville-West, Virginia Woolf, Elizabeth Debicki, and it's Vita Sackville-West's husband here, Harold Nicholson, played by Rupert Penry-Jones. So they're listening to, or there's a radio interview going on. So we'll hear it kind of jumping from listening to the radio to in the radio studio, so you'll hear that difference in sound.
In our third series of discussions entitled Modern Marriage, Mr. Harold Nicholson and his wife, the distinguished novelist Vita Sackville-West, share with us their thoughts on the foundation of a modern marriage.
I didn't sign a marriage contract. I negotiated one.
And I found a great deal more flexibility than I was brought up to expect. Would you agree?
I would. Marriage is less a piece of furniture, more like a plant, a living organism in need of constant nurture.
It is not something we own, but something we grow.
And in so doing, we are offered the opportunity to nurture it
in our own image.
Yes, but it does seem that men tend to regard themselves the plant and women the soil. This is a poor state of affairs for both sexes. I enjoy the qualities in myself that may be said to be masculine.
And so do I, darling. Nevertheless, I would argue that the most virile woman
is infinitely more feminine than the most feminine man.
That kind of thinking implies damaging absolutes. That there is something necessarily passive about the feminine, and therefore that it should always be the woman who surrenders her opportunities.
Now, you do agree that
the joys of motherhood are sufficient compensation for any such sacrifice?
Emphatically not.
Are you saying that your success as a best-selling writer thrills you more than your duties as a mother?
My professional success satisfies a different stomach. Independence has no sex.
Gemma Arterton there as Vita Sackville-West, Harold Nicholson played by Rupert Penry-Jones, and we also had a very posh BBC announcer.
Don't we love the 1920s for those accents and the costumes?
Straight in central casting that particular announcer. At any rate, I suppose we get a sense there that Vita Sackville-West, she was a popular and successful novelist in her day, but not in the same category, I think she would agree, and most people would agree, as Virginia Woolf. This is, whatever about marriage and talks about marriage, this is essentially the story of the two women, Ruth.
It absolutely is, and it hangs on them. And even though, you know, we did have Harold Nicholson, who is, you know, somebody who was very well known in his own right in that sequence. Actually, he's very much incidental.
He was a diarist and a diplomat.
Yeah,
wasn't
and
he?
A diplomat, and actually, they did have two children, and their son has written a lot about. I mean, we know a huge amount about their lives as a gay man and as a bisexual woman through the son recounting their story over and over again. But in fact, he's very much secondary in this, as is Leonard. I mean, slightly less.
This is Leonard Woolf,
Virginia Woolf's husband. So it is about the two women, and it really hinges, I think, on the performances and the casting. So Gemma Arterton, who is actually actually also the producer. This is her project. She brought it to the director. She initiated it. And she takes center stage as Vita Sackville West. And then Elizabeth Debicki, who I had never seen before. It was just stunning as Virginia Woolf. I mean, she really carries this film. And she's what made it for me was her
performance. Its origins, however, are in the theatre. And it was a series of letters between the two women. And possibly there were letters to the husband as well. It was a two-hander. It was just the two women in theatre. How does that translate to the screen?
I think Ruth made a very good point when you're talking about people being incidental. You know, even though there's lots more people in this and there's lots more settings that are involved, it still feels very much like it is just a two-hander. You know, so no matter how much things change, even as the film goes on, they become almost, if anything else, more incidental to it, and it comes back probably much closer to the stage play as it progresses.
All right. Plays, you know, what works as dialogue on stage does not necessarily work as dialogue in a film.
Yeah, this was the weak point of it for me, which was the wordiness. And because in much of the film, they actually read out the letters aloud that they wrote to each other. So you have one of the actors speaking to camera, reading. And then the film goes into sort of soft focus at that point. There's far too much of this soft focus for me. It has to halt the action in order to have the reading. I think they could have done a much better job on keeping it whipping along, because then what they also do, and we just heard it in that soundtrack, they have a slightly strange soundtrack that is quite modern.
Yeah, but it's techno. There's a techno soundtrack. Yeah,
and so I think that's meant to keep it moving in a way. The soundtrack is meant to keep it moving when the action slows down.
Yeah, it's by, I haven't written her name down, but Phoebe Waller-Bridge's sister.
Yes, that's right.
Phoebe of Fleabag and all of the rest of it.
So keeping it in the family.
Killing Eve.
And it is, I mean, I also found, I mean, the interiors, there is a sort of fascination with the Bloomsbury set, you know, total sort of fetishization of that, you know, the lifestyle. But these are also very, very privileged people, and there is a lot of kind of lingering on the interiors and the gardens, and of course the Sackville Wests were extraordinary gardeners as well, and they're famous for
Isabel
that.
Isabel Waller-Bridge, by the way, is her name. Quite handy.
So you know, it is for me a film of two parts. On the one hand, the performance is fantastic, particularly Elizabeth Debicki. On the other hand, the wordiness and this lingering on the interiors, and I didn't kind of go for the soundtrack myself too much.
Yeah. What about this? We're in a very specific period. We're in that Bloomsbury set, yes. London, you know, bohemian society. How does it look from that point of view, Simon?
It looks fantastic. You know, they've obviously got, but I was going to think they've gone out of the way to try and recreate it. But a lot of it is represented of 1920s London is represented by North Great George Street.
Yeah, because it
looks great. You know, obviously I wasn't around in the 1920s, but it's in filmmaking terms.
Same architecture.
As you would expect it to look, and as a film, it does look great. But I agree totally on the funny soft focus thing. But even on the soft focus, they would do a little bit where they'll sharpen maybe the character's eyes. Yes. While they're reading a letter, and it's a lot of time it's a little bit jarring. So while you've got the soundtrack which is trying to move it along, you've got that really, really long lingering shot with the funny focus, and you think, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know quite what it's doing.
All right, so that sounds as if it didn't quite work for either of you. You first of all, Simon, did it work? Yes or no? In stars?
I found it interesting. It's a very interesting story, so I found it interesting rather than compelling. So I give it 3.
3. What are you saying, Ruth?
Same for me. 3. You know. Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, but I didn't feel emotionally absorbed into it.
All right, so 3 from both of you on that. Let's move on then to Never Look Away. This is from Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. I think most people will know him from the Oscar-winning Lives of Others. This is kind of based on reality, but it's part of the reason that it's taken so long to get to the screen. There's a bit of a falling out around that, isn't there, Ruth?
Yeah, there was a very public falling out because it is a disguised version of the artist Gerhard Richter's true life story, which is so extraordinary. And as a true life story, absolutely extraordinary story. Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, who's the director of the film, consulted with Richter over a long period of time, listened to his story, and then remade it as a fiction film, always in the belief that Richter was enjoying what he was doing and liked what he was doing. When the film was finished, Richter said, this is not what I thought was going to happen, and he distanced himself from the film. And that has very much... there's been two sets of responses to this. One, film is film, and one, the kind of art critic world, which despises it.
Right. So the character of Kurt, then, is the equivalent of the Richter character, yes. I'm guessing. So who is Kurt, played by Tom Schilling? What's his situation? His aunt is very important in his life story, isn't she?
He is. Well, it's a film that's basically divided into three sections. It's him as a little boy, and he is going around. His aunt who's, brings him everywhere, you know, and his aunt's a little bit, I don't even think of the words that you'd use for, but his aunt is somewhat temperamental, but is also somebody who really wants him to see things and to see great beauties. Never look away, Kurt. Everything true is beautiful. So she takes him everywhere. Then there's an incident happens and the aunt is taken away, and that pretty much shapes whatever happens. And there's echoes of that are going to come back on him in the second two periods, which is kind of his adolescence period and then his adult period then when he's moved to West Germany.
All right. And the aunt is Elizabeth, played by Saskia Rosendahl. But one of the big important characters here is Sebastian Koch, who was in the lives of others as the player is.
He's a playwright.
Yeah, he was a good, well, he's a goodie.
Yeah,
he's the baddie in this. Well, the villain.
Absolutely, he's the villain in this. I mean, this is set, you know, it opens in 1937 in Dresden. And so the exhibition that they go to see is an exhibition of quote unquote degenerate art. And so we're just mapping the rise of Nazism, of fascism in Germany. And so some of the Professor Seebandt, who's Sebastian Koch, is a gynecologist, and it is he who is performing sterilization operations on young women who are deemed to be inessential to the reproduction of the Aryan race. And so while Elizabeth looks Aryan enough to be actually asked to give a bouquet of flowers to Hitler when there's a public event, she in fact then, because of her poor mental health, is considered to be unfit for reproduction, and so she must be sterilised and then euthanised.
And so it's fairly serious stuff. And this has a basis in reality. Paula Beer is the daughter of the villain, and to make matters more confusing or more complex, she falls in love with Kurt.
She does. So Kurt goes off and goes to university, and he goes off and meets a fashion student, Ellie Elizabeth, and then she says, "Well, there's a room free in our house if you want to come and stay." And it's like, this is a brilliant thing. They arrive at the house.
Yeah. So look, we're saying a lot of what happens, but this is all true life.
Oh, this, absolutely.
I'm guessing that this film is not about what happens.
No, absolutely not.
It's about is it about?
There's a lot of the film is about the whole world of the artist himself, and even all of this stuff that's happened, and then when he starts to draw, he does the very famous murals, you know, but he himself has this absolute self-doubt, and he feels the only way that he can get it through any of this self-doubt is by painting these things. But even he's mentioning quite far in, and this film goes on for quite some time, he's talking quite far in about, have I ever done anything that's any good?
So this is the film that made me go through the timings of the movies, and that the fact that you'd been there for 7 hours, but I noticed that you said the 3 hours here was not a problem at all, Ruth.
No, it glided by for me because I was thinking, 3 hours, but it is absolutely, I find it absolutely immersive. It is beautiful. It's, I think, important to go to the cinema and see it, and to have, you know, the incredible images
experience
on the screen. It's got a very, very complex soundtrack. I mean, I found the soundtrack a little bit was cueing me emotionally.
I think you found the same sound too much.
But it is, you know, it is absolutely completely immersive, and it's a melodrama, so it is about good people, bad people, extraordinary coincidences, and as you said, self-doubt, but it's also about what it means, how do you represent trauma.
Okay, stars from you, Ruth?
I gave it 4 out of 5 because actually, despite my reservations, I did
really
love
liked it. And Simon?
I'd give it a 3.5 out of 5.
All right, that's Simon and Simon Marr and Ruth Barton speaking to us about Spider-Man Far From Home and Vita and Virginia. They're both on general release. Never Look Away is on limited release.